One of the great pleasures, as you might imagine, of holding such a event is to watch YouTube or whatever it may be, or X, kind of in this case, and you develop, you know, you become a fan of somebody. And it's really cool because some of them, if they ain't too famous, you know, and Jay's right on the edge, you can have come and get to meet them, you know. And I was a fan of Jay Anderson and have been for many years on Twitter. But he's a special kind of communicator. And let me tell you a little bit about him. He's quietly become one of the most trusted interviewers in the world of hidden history, UFOs, and high strangeness. You will know him from Project Unity. It's a long-form interview platform where serious thinkers come to explore the edges of science, consciousness, and the unknown. Jay's YouTube channel has become essential viewing for those who want more than clickbait and conspiracy and instead seek thoughtful, open-minded inquiry into some of the biggest mysteries of our time. Over the years, Jay has spoken with intelligence insiders, academics, experiencers, and visionaries, always with respect, insight, and curiosity. That's why you'll find so many of this week's speakers have also appeared on his show. Jay is also anchoring our Cosmic News Desk at times throughout the weekend, helping us make sense of this paradigm-shifting content coming your way. But right now, from Project Unity, Jay Anderson is here to speak directly to you. Mr. Jay Anderson, please come up.
My name is Henry.
Hey, everyone. Can you hear me okay? Good to see you all. This is my first time at the Cosmic Summit, so thank you, George. Can I get a round of applause for George, please, in setting this incredible event up? And it is my third time speaking on stage, so try and forgive me if I'm a little bit nervous. It's not easy. It's one of the biggest fears I think most people have is public speaking, but I feel ready, and I hope I've got an interesting presentation for you guys today. Thank you. Yeah, the shattered evidence of a suppressed history. Once we step away from the beaten path of mainstream history and archaeology, and we begin to apply a critical eye to what we're seeing, you can't help but be taken aback by the massive contradictions, the anomalies, the unexplainable architecture and engineering that we see scattered across the ancient world on a global scale. What I want to do today is present some incredible examples of how the mainstream interpretations of history, linear development in human evolution, are severely lacking in their ability to explain these anomalies. Once examined with the appropriate scrutiny, we begin to see a particular form of laziness that masquerades as academic sensibility and educated opinion, but in reality, what we're seeing is an avoidance of problematic elements in the models that we've been used to explain our world and explain our human story. These models are broken, and when we reveal the shattered pieces that have been left behind on the wayside, we're called conspiracy theorists and pseudoscientists, and yet these anomalies do exist, and they demand a real explanation. So I want to take you through as many anomalies in history as I can in the short time I have with you today. Hopefully, you'll come across some things you've never heard of before. And perhaps I can leave you questioning the narratives we're being given on what our ancestors were actually capable of. So let's start with something that I think many of you will probably be familiar with, the Antikythera mechanism. This was discovered in 1901 by sponge divers off the coast of the island of Antikythera between mainland Greece and Crete. Estimated to have been built around 100 to 200 BC, this intricate device is often called the world's first analog computer. It's believed to have been used to predict celestial events like eclipses, planetary motions, and even the timing of the Olympic Games. But what makes it a profound anomaly is the unprecedented complexity of its bronze gearwork. This complex device uses differential gearing. Now, differential gearing shouldn't have existed in the ancient world of Greece. This type of gear precision would not be seen again until the development of complex European astronomical clocks in the 14th century. So that's over 1,300 years before that period. So this mechanism forces a radical reconsideration of ancient technological capabilities and suggest that high-level mechanical knowledge was developed, then somehow lost to history. And we don't see these mechanisms widely distributed through ancient dig sites and dive spots in Greece. It stands quite simply as a singular anomaly. And yet, it exists. So the fact that it exists means that there is a contradiction in our period of history that informs us that there was actually deeper knowledge sets, more advanced understanding that was occurring outside of the mainline developmental curve of that time and was actually exceeding it. So this puts a lot of stress on the linear developmental chronology that we assign to human history, the idea that progression occurred in a straight line from A to B to C, does not appear to be correct. Oh, not yet. The complexity of this Antikythera mechanism suggests a developmental lineage, but we don't find that lineage in earlier models or prototypes. It simply appears out of nowhere, with nothing really to justify its existence 1,300 years before differential gearing was apparently rediscovered rather than invented in the 14th century. I would say it's one of the best examples of complex technological knowledge existing at a time period where it absolutely was not supposed to be, based on the mainstream interpretations of the overall capabilities and the available systems and methods that are attributed to ancient Greece. But there are other examples to go through that cause us to reconsider the historical blueprint that we have been operating with in the modern world. What we're taught in school, I would say, is dubious at best. So another striking example of archaic technology that should not be present in the time period that we discover them in are the Baghdad batteries. This is a group of artifacts that were discovered in the 1930s near Kujat Rabu, close to modern-day Baghdad, Iraq. They've been dated to around 250 BC to 250 CE during the Parthian or Sassanid periods. Each of these objects consists of a clay jar containing a copper cylinder and an iron rod. These were then sealed with asphalt, and when filled with an acidic liquid like vinegar or lemon juice, modern experiments have shown that these vessels can actually produce a small electrical charge, around 0.5 to 1 volts. Now, that's not much voltage, but it can have practical uses, suggesting that these jars may have functioned as early galvanic cells and could have been used to perform electroplating on metals. So electroplating is the process... Electroplating is the process of using an electric current to deposit a thin layer of metal like gold or silver or zinc onto the surface of another metal object. It involves submerging both the object that's going to be plated and a piece of the metal to be deposited into an electrolyte solution and then running a current between them. So if the Baghdad batteries were filled with an acidic electrolyte like vinegar, the copper and iron components could act as electrodes, producing a low voltage current. And so by connecting the battery to a metallic object that's submerged in a solution containing metal ions, like, for example, silver nitrate, this current could actually cause the metal from the solution to gradually coat the selected object. The functionality of these 2,000-plus-year-old jars as simple batteries has actually been demonstrated repeatedly in laboratory conditions. And so, once again, we come across an anomaly in the ancient past, not widely distributed across the local cultures and civilizations of that period, but it exists. And so, once again, like the Antikythera mechanism, we have to accept that it exists. And this, by default, means we have to accept that more advanced capabilities were present in ancient times than our current models of history give credit for. Now, this is a really weird one. Hands up if any of you have seen this before. A few of you. Okay, good. This beautifully crafted, ornate, 4th century goblet is called the Lycurgus cup, and it's the earliest known example of the implementation of nanotechnology. How is this using nanotechnology? Well, you'll notice in these images on the screen that the cup displays itself in a series of striking color schemes. Under normal light, it appears opaque green. But when light passes through it from behind, it suddenly glows a rich, vibrant red. Now, this effect is called dichroism, but it's not just artistic, it's highly scientific. Modern analysis of this cup, which is currently being housed in the British Museum in London, revealed that whoever was responsible for creating this cup had somehow suspended nanoscale particles of gold and silver about 50 to 100 nanometers wide within the glass matrix. These nanoparticles interact with light in complex ways and create something called surface plasmon resonance. The scattering and the absorbing of different wavelengths depending on how the light hits the surface. And this is what causes these unique color shifts. Now, here's the thing. To create this effect intentionally, one would require an understanding of particle size, light behavior, and metallurgy that modern science only began to unravel in the 20th century. Yet this cup was made in the 4th century and predates the discovery of modern nanotechnology by about 1,600 years. So this is a happy accident, perhaps, or a lost branch of material science. Well, when we begin to connect the dots, rather than treating each of these anomalies as if they were in a vacuum on their own, you begin to realize that, you know, it's not just one example or two examples or three examples of some form of high technology. There's actually countless examples, from ancient computational systems and archaic batteries to potential nanotechnology. The list continues on. Like this next one, for example, this is very interesting. Roman concrete, specifically a certain variant of Roman concrete that has self-healing properties and becomes stronger over time. The standard concrete that we use in modern construction doesn't hold a candle to this far older and more fascinating methodology. Excuse me. Get a little bit of water here. Yes, this far older and far more fascinating methodology that was deployed by the Romans. But in my opinion, I would argue that the Romans did not discover this. It was more likely, the Romans did not invent this. It was more likely a discovery. As they raided and conquered the old world and gathered knowledge from times long before their own history began, much of which I would say is now safely tucked away in places like the apostolic archives of the Vatican Church. This concrete, known as opus cementitium, contains a unique blend of volcanic ash, lime, and seawater. But what truly makes it extraordinary is a natural process called pozzolanic reaction. Over time, especially in marine environments, this mix doesn't just resist decay, it actually grows crystalline structures that reinforce the concrete, sealing cracks and regenerating its own structural integrity. So in short, it gets stronger as it gets older, it gets stronger as it gets damaged. Modern scientists only recently began to uncover how aluminium tabemarite and philipsite crystals form inside this ancient mix, creating a self-strengthening matrix. Now, it was only in 2023 that scientists over at MIT were able to recreate this concrete in modern times. But even still, they had to use a synthetic variant. They could not replicate the exact recipe that the Romans were utilizing. So what does that tell us? Either that the Romans stumbled upon this by chance and mastered its use through trial and error, or perhaps they inherited this technique from a much earlier civilization with a deeper, more intuitive knowledge of material science. And we should now move on to something else that the Romans are attributed for, but I will argue until I'm blue in the face on this issue that there is no way that first century Romans were capable of what you're about to see. Baalbek, Lebanon, the stone of the pregnant woman, weighing around 1,100 tons of pure limestone. Absolutely colossal in scale. In the same quarry, we have the Stone of the South, This one weighs in at about 1,242 tons of Jurassic limestone. And then we have what is called the third stone. This is, in fact, the heaviest megalithic block ever quarried. And it weighs in at around 1,650 to 1,800 tons. Now, it's hard to imagine what the intended purpose of these blocks could have been. And admittedly, these blocks never left the quarry site. However, 500 meters up the road, give or take, is a site that mainstream archaeologists and historians have assigned to first century Romans, the Temple of Jupiter. Now, it's certainly true that much of this temple was constructed by the Romans in the first century. But just like so many other areas around the world, whether it's Egypt or Peru or anywhere in between, what we see here is, in fact, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many others, an example of discovery and reconstruction. The Romans found a ruined temple and its foundations, and they built their own temple upon it. And why can we say this? Well, we can say this because of the Trilithon stones. These are the Trilithon stones, three stone blocks that have been lifted approximately 30 feet above the ground. They were quarried from the same site as the megalithic blocks I just showed you, meaning that they were lifted and moved roughly 500 meters to the site, and then lifted 30 feet into the air. Now, this might not seem like much, especially in comparison to, you know, things like the 50 to 70 ton granite blocks of the King's Chamber, which turned out to originate from a quarry some 500 miles away in Aswan. Nevertheless, we're still talking about blocks of up to 1,000 tons. Moving them at all is incredible, especially in such ancient times. The Trilithon stones are estimated to weigh in excess of 800 tons each in the conservative range, with some estimates reaching 1,000 tons. Now, we have a bit of a problem here. Roman historian Ammianus boasted of the Roman Empire's heaviest stone lift, the Lateran obelisk, taken from Alexandria to Rome, where it remains to this day. Now, the Lateran obelisk weighs around 350 to 400 tons. Very impressive. There's no denying that is an incredibly impressive lift. The issue is that the Trilithon stones, even at conservative estimates, are double the weight of the Lateran obelisk. And yet, the Romans never documented this. They never spoke of this incredible feat of moving 800-ton stones. Do you find that strange? I find that strange. They documented all of the things that they were extremely proud of. But they didn't talk about this. And to give you an even better perspective on it, in order to lift and place the Baalbek Trilithon stones as they appear, 30 feet high and fitted with tight precision in the modern era, you'd need one of the largest cranes in the world, such as the Liebherr LR13000 or the Sarenz SGC250, combined with cutting-edge engineering, GPS-guided control, and an elite crew. Even then, it would be an extraordinary feat. And yet, mainstream archaeologists and historians will insist the first century Romans achieved these lifts. Just some more examples of the kind of cranes that we'd expect to be used for this type of lift. And then, this is what we're told they used. Okay? Wooden cranes and pulleys. It makes no sense. It makes absolutely no sense. Once again, our models for history are broken. And we can see where the Romans did their work. Admittedly, fantastic work. But it is simpler, and the blocks are far smaller. All around the Baalbek Temple region, and by the way, these screenshots were done by an individual who runs a YouTube channel called Megalithomania. He is here today, and I do apologize, my bro. I have forgotten your name. I'm so sorry. But Megalithomania is the YouTube channel where I got these screenshots from, and he went around Baalbek Temple. Fantastic video, so make sure you check them out. All around the Baalbek Temple region, we see these scattered and extremely weathered remains of truly colossal blocks that seem out of place in comparison to what is clearly the smaller scale work of the Romans that discovered these far more ancient and megalithic foundations and ruins. If the Romans were responsible for this, they would have said something. These Trilithon stones and the foundations of the temple itself, alongside these truly gigantic blocks in the quarry nearby, were not made by the Romans. It is yet another example of colossal prehistoric architecture that I would argue stretches back over 12,000 years. And this work may have been abruptly stopped by the rise in global sea level and geological traumas that we assign to the Younger Dryas period of 12,800 years ago. That might explain why those blocks never left the quarry. And there are many examples across the world of ancient foundations using hundreds of tons worth of stone, showing extreme degradation and damage, evidence perhaps of a global cataclysm that is spoken of across the world, represented by over 200 different cultures. This place is fascinating. This is Tanis in Egypt. Clearly once a thriving hub of the ancient world, it now stands as a site of unimaginable destruction. Its remnants are buried beneath layers of desert sand, rarely explored, and to be honest, only minimally excavated. Tanis remains a sleeping giant in the world of Egyptology, hiding what might be one of the most compelling cases of catastrophic damage in antiquity. What's been uncovered so far paints a chilling picture. Scattered ruins bear unmistakable signs of intense high energy impact and thermal trauma that defies conventional explanation. Among the most striking anomalies at Tanis are melted statues and megalithic blocks, many of which are made out of quartzite. Quartzite is an incredibly hard stone, with a melting point of approximately 1,700 degrees centigrade, a temperature that exceeds that of volcanic lava. Now, these objects do not simply show erosion or chipping, but rather flow-like deformation, burnt surfaces, and globular formations that are eerily reminiscent of molten candle wax. The implications are profound. Really, only a sudden and extraordinarily high heat event could produce this kind of damage. And yet, no volcanoes exist in this area, and in typical form, the mainstream historical record does have no suggestion for the sources of what caused this destruction. They don't address this. And like I said, minimal excavation is really not being looked at very deeply at all, Tanis. This isn't an isolated phenomena. Similar patterns of stone vitrification, melting, and intense heat damage have been identified at other ancient sites around the world. Some of these images are from Brian Forrester in Peru, also areas in Turkey and parts of the Middle East, all hinting at a shared signature of something unfathomably powerful and destructive. It should make all of us consider the ancient stories, once again, that are represented across over 200 cultures worldwide, of global destruction, global reset. It seems ever more likely that we are the traumatized offspring of this bygone era, now picking up the pieces of our ancestors' story, trying to make sense of it. Then we have these strange signatures I'm sure a lot of you have seen. They're present all over the world where megalithic, multi-ton stone building projects are found. These protrusions that are usually called nubs, they're found in strange places, asymmetric in their location, counterintuitive to most normal engineering functions, and we can't really explain them. Some suggestions are that they are potentially for ropes and pulleys, holders or handles, but this falls short of fully explaining them, again, because they appear in strange places. The explanations fail in fully resolving what these nubs actually are. Personally, one of the most interesting theories to me, and one that I think may actually hold a level of weight, is the idea that this is evidence of softening the stone. And what we're seeing here is the leftover mark from where a tool has been pulled out of the stone, possibly a form of injection mold. You think about piping cream into a donut, right? And you have to fill it up. And when you remove the pipe, you get a little nub of cream from the opening well. Well, perhaps that's what we're seeing here, like a spoon being pulled away from soft toffee or caramel and leaving some excess behind. It's certainly possible when you see the incredible examples of stonework that appear to have been melted together, which we see again most prominently in Peru. There are examples of this anomalous method in other areas of the world, such as the Giza Plateau in Egypt, like Menkar Pyramid here, but I would argue that Peru has the densest concentration of highly advanced examples of this very, very strange method. Another globally represented pattern with these megalithic structures alongside the stone nubs, these protrusions we just discussed. The stone building methods themselves share striking similarities all over the world. It's a method called Cyclopean stone building. And as you can see, we have various countries where it is present. It's a process of fitting extremely large, oddly shaped stones into precision placement, joining them together without any mortar, no cement, no binding agent at all. And yet we find these examples all over the ancient world at such incredible scale and at such mind-blowing precision that you can rarely even fit a human hair between the joinery of each stone. And it would seem that this technique once again reached its apex in Peru. As I said, this method of building is found everywhere, but in Peru it is on another level. And one of the best examples is Sacsayhuaman in Cusco. Now this site is attributed to the Inca civilization of around 825 years ago. The Inca were primarily a copper tool using civilization with some access to bronze, but primarily copper tools and hammer stones, which are hard stones that would be used to break up and shape other stones. So they had a very, very simple toolkit at their disposal. And one of the most important things to highlight is the discrepancy in both hardness and precision in relation to the tools available to the Inca, the type of stone that we see being used in these incredible megalithic sites, and the level of precision that has been used to cut, shape, and fit these stones together. Now, if you were in Matt Beal's conversation before his talk earlier, you would see something similar to this. He spoke about the measurement of hardness scale. Now, this is a scale for metals and minerals that go up to 10. Diamond, for example, is 10 out of 10 on the Mohs scale, the measurement of hardness scale. Now, many of these ancient sites that we see here that showcase an astonishing level of precision cutting and joining are made primarily from granite, andesite, diorite, and basalt. These are all incredibly hard stone materials. They sit at about 6 to 7.5 out of 10 on the Mohs scale. Copper sits at about 2.5 out of 10. Okay? I'll repeat that. The stone materials that have been precision cut and precision joined without any mortar or cement between them, joined to a level where you can often struggle to fit a human hair between them, sit at 6 to 7.5 out of 10 in hardness. The tools we attribute to their creation sit at 2.5 out of 10. Give you an idea of the feasibility. So just like a plastic knife can't make a meaningful cut in steel, a copper tool can't cut, smooth, interlock with precision, granite, diorite, andesite. It's not possible. So the mainstream will say, well, they did not use their copper tools. They used stones of similar hardness to create these blocks. But when you look at that precision, the absolutely perfect precision, the level of accuracy cannot be fashioned through rough stone abrasion, right? The idea that you're literally just smashing rocks together and then rubbing them down to create this. I'm sorry, to suggest this is absurd. And this is what I mean by academic laziness. They can't explain the precision, and they don't intend to. They simply attribute this work to the Inca and move on. What you'll notice on to the right of this image is a far simpler wall made of rough cut stone and using mortar as a binding agent. This is what the Inca were doing, not the stonework on the left. they found this stonework and they build their own structures around them. Here's another example. As you can see on the left, we have incredible precision engineering and stone cutting. On the right, we have simple stone walls. Again, there are those that will argue that these are different styles of building from the same culture. This is not logical. This is like comparing a Ferrari to a horse and cart and saying the same tools we use to make both of them. No, what we see in Peru is very good evidence for the Inca finding these places and building around them, trying to preserve them, incorporating them into their own structures. But the difference between the general building style of the Inca and these megalithic works are night and day. And I'm not satisfied with the conclusions of the mainstream. I think they are wrong, and I think the evidence is on my side for this. Also, if you actually go to Peru and you speak to some of the indigenous cultures and you speak to the shamans and the oral keepers of tradition, they will tell you that these buildings were not created by the Inca. They were created by a lost civilization long before their time. It's only the Western historians and archaeologists and who, you know, they go to these places and then they just assign their own narrative to it. And they come back and they teach us, and that's what we regurgitate. But when you actually go to these places, like, for example, Graham Hancock went over and speaks to these people, and they will tell you this is from a lost time period. Again, another example where you can compare and contrast between this extremely simple stone wall building technique of the Inca and the absolute precision, perfect engineering of the megalithic stone building projects who, in my opinion, were created by people present on this planet over 12,000 years ago and lived through a global cataclysm that shattered these civilizations into pieces. And we are now in the process of putting the puzzle back together and finding massive discrepancies in our historical narratives. Again, just some more examples from across Peru of this hyper-advanced stone building technique. Truly, truly remarkable. I don't think that should be there. Uh-oh. That should not be there. I apologize. I'm just going to skip ahead real quick just to see where that's going. Sorry about that, guys. I don't actually know why my presentation has suddenly jumped to there. But okay, right. It's okay. It's all right. I'll figure this out. It's all right. Don't worry. Operating on the fly. Thank you, guys. I might actually just be worrying about this, and it's not even a problem, so don't worry. In the modern era of science, yeah, sorry, here we go. I've got you now. I'm on it. I want to show you an example or two, if I've got time, of acoustic sciences being demonstrated at levels that extend far beyond the mere understanding and appreciation of music and move more into archaeoacoustic technology that taps into fundamental biophysical mechanisms in human beings. You know what it was? I just honestly didn't think I've been up here for that long, so I'm actually at the right place in my presentation. I was just like, time's flowing by really quick up here. It's like a transcendental experience being up here, honestly. In the modern era of science, we're discovering just how important of a role sound, acoustic vibration, frequency can have on our bodies and our mind. Sound influences the brain, it influences the body, it influences perception and emotion. And what fascinates me the most, and it's something that we find distributed all across the world, is the fact that a sophisticated science of acoustics was being represented at a profound level during the so-called Neolithic or Stone Age period, where we assume humans to have been at a really primitive state of existence. No civilizational framework, no complex knowledge sets or languages. And yet they appear to have an incredible knowledge of not just acoustics, but the ability to engineer large-scale, multi-ton structures to be acoustically resonant at specific frequencies to produce specific effects. Now, this is called archaeoacoustics or psychoacoustic architecture, if we're going to invoke the idea that this was actually influencing consciousness, psychoacoustic architecture. And there is far too much of it going on in the Stone Age for me to be convinced that we have a good understanding of the Stone Age. I think it was actually the Age of Stone, and I think there's a big difference between the two, a big difference. So it's within this ancient and forgotten period of time that we find some of the most striking examples of acoustic technology being engineered into megalithic stone building projects. And one of the most profound examples of this can be found on the island of Malta. Now, I recently returned from Malta as I've been filming a documentary on the advanced prehistoric sites of Malta and the neighboring island of Gozo. And I was also there to assist the Khafre Pyramid Project team who are sitting over there, Filippo and Armando. I'll be introducing them to the stage after the lunch break, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Now, these islands contain the largest concentration of prehistoric megalithic sites in the world. And underneath the limestone of this Mediterranean island is an acoustic resonance complex that defies conventional explanation. It's called the Hypogeum of Halsefliene. Now, this subterranean structure, carved entirely out of solid limestone with no evidence of metal tools, dates back to at least 3,600 BC. Placing it deep into what we would label as the Neolithic era. Personally, I would argue its origin point extends much further back, as would many of the Maltese locals that I spoke to during my trip, many thousands of years further back than conventional dating will allow for. And yet, what we find here is not a crude shelter or a basic tomb. We find a precision-engineered, multi-chambered acoustic complex. At the heart of this marvel is what's known as the Oracle Room. The Oracle Room is a small chamber with acoustically tuned architecture that resonates at exactly 111 hertz. This frequency is not arbitrary. It's within a range known to affect brain function, particularly influencing activity in the prefrontal cortex, the limbic system, and the thalamus. When low male vocal tones, like a baritone voice, especially chanting, are projected into the oracle room, the chamber amplifies and circulates the sound throughout the entire structure. Experiments with EEG sensors have shown that exposure to this resonance can induce altered states of consciousness, including enhanced theta wave activity, often associated with deep meditation, intuition, and non-ordinary states of awareness. Go away, mosquito. In essence, the chamber is not just an echoic marvel. It's a biophysical interface, a device that leverages the natural frequencies of the human body and brain to entrain consciousness, perhaps as part of a ritual, initiation, or healing practice. I'll let you read that real quick. I want to take a sip of water. It's a very restricted site as well. When I went there, they take your phone, they take your electronics, you're not allowed to take any photographs, everything has to be locked away. It's like going into a skiff in a government building. Like you're treated like you're going into a classified site. You're only allowed to see, I think, about 20% of the Hypogeum. 70% of it is locked off to the public. No access allowed. Moreover, the Hypogeum's layout follows a harmonic geometry with curved surfaces and spatial ratios that mirror those found in resonant cavities like the human cranium or the inner ear, suggesting an intuitive or inherited understanding of somatic acoustics. The structure may have functioned as a biosonic chamber, capable of inducing trance states, emotional release, or even facilitating intersubjective experiences during group rituals. So what we have here is not simply an echo chamber or a tomb, although countless skeletons were discovered in the depths of this mysterious complex, and strangest of all, reports of dozens of elongated skulls. Now, one of these skulls is actually on display at the Museum of Archaeology in the city of Valletta in Malta. I have video footage of this skull, which you're seeing still frames of now. And the most important aspect of these particular skulls is the fact that they lack a critical element of the human anatomy. The sagittal suture, which divides the two parietal bones along the top of the human skull. It's a critical component of the skull. As the baby is pushed through the birth canal, the pressure pushes these two parts of the skull together and helps fuse them for the next phase of development. But this is absent in the skull in the Valletta Museum. It's elongated, far beyond standard skull size, but unlike head binding, this formation is not artificially provoked. Whoever this person was, they were born this way. But they were born lacking a critical component of human skull development. And yet this is an adult skull. It's not an infant. So they were alive and well at some point in time, but with a non-human or a very non-typical human skull. What's quite interesting about Malta are the ancient stories of giants and the legend of a female giant with her baby slung over her shoulder carrying multi-ton stones and building these incredible temples that litter the islands. It's interesting to consider that a significantly wider birth canal in a giant female might actually explain why the same birthing process is not needed. The skull formation is not the same. It's not necessary to have the same sort of pressure. I'm not saying that's the case, just putting it out there. And, you know, the Maltese legends speak of this kind of stuff. And giants are not just restricted to Malta. Very interesting, the whole history of theologic texts and ancient traditions that speak of giants. So the absence of this critical skull suture suggests either a developmental anomaly or potentially a distinct genetic trait, raising significant questions about the identity, the origin, and the biological nature of these individuals. The presence of multiple skulls with this unique trait, found within the confines of a subterranean, acoustically active structure, adds even further intrigue to the case. Were these beings a priestly class, genetic outliers, or something entirely other? When you combine the skull findings with the biophysical and psychoacoustic properties of the hypogeum, the precisely tuned 111 Hz resonance, the harmonic architectural scaling, and the evidence for multisensory ritual induction, you're no longer looking at burial chambers. You're potentially looking at, like I said before, bioenergetic interface, a chamber designed to entrain consciousness and perhaps to communicate with or become something beyond the individual self. And the fact that this was built by a supposedly primitive Stone Age culture makes the implications all the more profound. It forces us to ask just how much of our history, just how much of our civilizational blueprint has been lost and also hidden away from us. Now, the last two slides could be a two-hour talk in their own right, but I will briefly explain that what we're seeing here are fundamental acoustic frequencies and their accompanying geometries. The study of how sound forms geometric patterns, cymatics. And what we see in the geometries created by various frequencies is an uncanny, striking, weird level of similarity between the geometry, between the geometric signatures created by acoustic vibration and the artwork and overall engineering design of sacred temples, cathedrals, churches. Across all religions and spiritual practices, you will find this beautiful complex geometry that inspires awe and reverence for something transcendent of human logic. In essence, the geometry of the divine, of God, which is why they are referred to as sacred geometries. This cannot be ignored. The true science of spirituality is a science of sound, of acoustics, of vibration. It is the key to unlocking a wider perception of reality through harmonically induced trance states. Think of it this way. There are geometries being created by the sound frequencies. Those sound frequencies enter your body. They wash over you, especially if the temple or sacred space has been deliberately tuned like a giant musical instrument to resonate these sacred scales and harmonics. So think about what's happening inside you when these harmonics are reverberating through your bone structure, through your blood, through the water in your body. These geometries will be occurring on a microscale level within you. And it would seem that the ancients knew how vital this was, how healing it could be, how transcendent it could be. We are barely even scraping the surface of what sound can do to our body, to our environment. And it would seem objectively obvious based on the artwork, the architectural design, and the deliberate acoustic tuning of ancient sacred spaces that our ancestors had a far deeper, far more sophisticated understanding of sound than we do today. I think this quote from Nikola Tesla encapsulates this realization perfectly. He said, "My brain is only a receiver. In the universe, there is a core from which we obtain knowledge, strength, and inspiration. I have not penetrated into the secrets of this core, but I know that it exists." I agree, Tesla, I agree. Now, there is more than I could possibly attempt to cover in 1 hour's time. I hope this introduction into the anomalies of history has been interesting, and I hope it sparked some curiosity in you that will inspire you to look into the issues yourself. There is 10 minutes left, so I can take some questions, but thank you so much, and I hope you've enjoyed this. Thank you.